It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new Wisconsin tourism ad shares the tradition of Wisconsin supper clubs. We'll ask you, what would you advertise to attract tourists to Wisconsin?
First, the state Senate held its final meeting yesterday, marking the end of a two-year legislative session. Lawmakers were at the Capitol late into the night looking at over 80 bills.
The ones that passed, including an online voter registration bill and a series of bills on opioid treatment and penalties, will be off to Governor Scott Walker's desk. The ones that weren't taken up at all are likely dead for this legislative session.
And here to tell us more is WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White, who was probably up very late last night. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what was that late night like?
You know, they wrapped up around 10 p.m., so that's pretty early for the legislature these days. But, you know, there weren't a ton of surprises last night. Legislative leaders tend to know what people are going to vote positively on, so they had a lot of bills sail through last night.
And I understand at least one has been signed already by Governor Scott Walker. What has already been signed?
That's right. Governor Scott Walker signed the online voter registration bill this morning. And basically what that bill does is it allows people who have a state-issued driver's license or ID card to register to vote online.
And that one ran into a little bit of headwinds, but it did ultimately prevail. Was there a lot of debate yesterday about that one?
You know, there wasn't a ton of debate on that. It did ultimately pass on party lines, as several things did last night. The concern was that the bill also eliminates special registration deputies, which are individuals that help people register to vote. And people said that the elimination of those deputies would compromise voter registration drives in the state.
And tell us about some of the others that did make it out of the session yesterday.
So some of the other bills that passed along party lines, like that voter registration bill, were four bills in the governor's college affordability package, as well as a high-capacity wells bill, changes regulation of high-capacity wells, and a ban on plastic bags.
So those are going forward, and opioid treatment bills. Now, there is a package of those as well. What was their fate last night?
That's right. So the opioid package, which is sponsored by Marinette Republican John Nygren of the Assembly, that actually passed with bipartisan support. There were five different bills in that package that passed last night. And basically what they do a variety of things, but Nygren has said that their intent is to expand access to treatment and to increase knowledge about addiction and different treatment options in the state.
And there was also a bill looking at a change to school revenue limits. Can you tell us about that one and what happened with that?
Sure. So that bill has inspired some controversy and some heated debate as it's made its way through the legislature. It also passed along party lines last night. In the beginning, the bill basically limited how much local governments could raise property taxes to pay for schools, basically to make up for cuts to fund the state's voucher system. So changes as the bill evolved gave more power to local governments. They could raise taxes more than originally thought. So the impact of the bill isn't quite as hefty as it was before, but it certainly still has some opponents.
And one that we've talked about this program, on this program, there was a bill looking at amnesty for sexual assault victims who could be, prior to the bill, ticketed for underage drinking. Tell us about that one.
Sure. So what proponents of that bill were hoping for was that, you know, if you removed the potential to get an underage drinking ticket, if you reported experiencing a sexual assault, that would encourage people to report assaults more. Sexual assaults on campuses have tended to be fairly underreported. And so proponents thought that taking away that underage drinking ticket would remove a barrier and encourage more people to come forward and get support.
Now, you had mentioned that at the beginning, some aspects of the governor's college affordability plan were passed. Not all of them were passed. Do you know what will happen with the pieces that weren't picked up on by the Senate?
Well, Veronica, those are basically dead this session. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said that the Assembly is not coming back, and the Senate is not coming back either. So the elements of the governor's plan that didn't get votes last night are not going to happen.
Well, we're talking with Laurel White right now, WPR State Capitol reporter, talking about last night's Senate session, the closing of the session, in fact. And Laurel, did anything especially come as a surprise last night? Sounds as though it was pretty straightforward, but anything stick out to you?
It was pretty straightforward. As I said before, legislative leaders tend to know what's going to pass, and if something isn't going to pass, they tend to leave it off the calendar. So everything on the docket, for the most part, did pass. There was one surprise toward the end of the session that some people may have heard about, and that was a little bit of controversy about a CBD oil bill, which some Democrats tried to bring to the floor for a vote.
And this is a marijuana derivative oil, essentially.
Yes, yeah. So CBD oil is derived from the marijuana plant. It has traces of THC, which is the active chemical in marijuana. And CBD oil has been used to treat some seizure disorders in children. And the oil is already legal in the state of Wisconsin. Since 2014, actually, it's been legal. But what this bill would have done would be to expand access to the oil so parents could actually get it rather than providers. And there were some concerns about that, according to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and that's why the bill wasn't allowed to come for a vote.
And what was the controversy that you heard?
Well, essentially, what Democrats tried to do was pull the bill to a vote, even though it wasn't on the calendar. And obviously, there was some opposition to that because people who had concerns about the bill didn't want it to be pulled for a vote. So there was a lot of procedural back and forth. And ultimately, that led to the state Senate adjourning rather abruptly at about 10 p.m. last night.
Now, one bill that did not make it out of the Senate last night that was a pretty high-profile bill, very contentious again, was the Sanctuary Cities Bill. Can you tell a little bit about why that didn't advance?
Yeah, again, that had been a pretty controversial bill. Thousands of people came to the Capitol to protest it last month. And it was not included on the Senate calendar for the end of this legislative session. So obviously there was some pretty high-profile opposition to the bill, and senators decided that they didn't want to weigh in on it and send it to the governor.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, joining us there to talk about the results of yesterday's last Senate session. We take a look at President Obama's nomination today of Merrick Garland to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Since the death of Justice Antonin Scalia last month, President Obama had stated very clearly that he's going to nominate someone to fill that seat, while the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate equally clearly says they would block any nomination made by the president. Joining us to discuss today's nomination of Merrick Garland is Barbara Perry. She's professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, let's give a listen to President Obama today.
I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence.
So that's what President Obama had to say about his nominee. What do we know about Merrick Garland and what kind of justice he might be?
He is, I would say, among the most meritorious of appointments, and most appointments to the Supreme Court are highly meritorious, but he would have to be ranked up there among the highest, with a Harvard degree undergraduate, summa cum laude valedictorian, magna cum laude graduate of Harvard Law School, Law Review, very much experience in the legal world and the judicial world. As a prosecutor, most people probably heard that he prosecuted Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing in the 1990s. So would come to the court with not only that, but 19 years experience on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is really a proving ground for the U.S. Supreme Court. And above all, he's been named the chief judge of that circuit. So he comes with the most demonstrable credentials one could imagine.
And the big question is, does any of that matter at all, given that Senate Republicans have said, nominate whoever you want, we will not only not confirm them, we won't even meet with them. Is this an offer they can't refuse?
In a word, yes, they can refuse because that is their right to do so. But as the president pointed out, the polls are showing 2/3 to 3/4 of Americans polled believe that whatever candidate he should put up as the nominee, that that person should have a fair and square up and down vote, have hearings, as is the tradition since the early 1900s, and certainly have the person come before the Judiciary Committee. That's a long tradition going back to the 50s. I think Americans want to see that and then want to see an up or down vote. That is not a filibuster, not no hearings, and not we're just ignoring this.
A lot of times the Supreme Court appointment in the last 30 years or so, the goal seems to be as far, if I'm the president, I want somebody who's as far on my side as I can possibly get confirmed and ideally young so they can be doing this job in a long time. Does this nomination meet that usual pattern?
No, and that's a very good point, Rob. That's why I think this one is unusual from that perspective, and that is that, first of all, Judge Garland is 63, so he would actually be considerably older than most put on the court, and that was a trend started by Reagan, who wanted Court of Appeals judges, as you said, had his view of the Constitution, his ideology, but all presidents try for that. But certainly for Reagan, he wanted to pick people in their early 50s, if possible, maybe even in their late 40s. So I think that was one concession that the president made, and I think the other is that Judge Garland is viewed as a moderate liberal, not far left, and I think that was another concession of the president to this status of his, as some people call him a lame duck, but in the midst of a presidential race with a Senate that is controlled by the opposite party.
Well, President Obama is throwing down the gauntlet, and he specifically addressed the Senate majority, the Republicans there.
If you don't, then it will not only be an abdication of the Senate's constitutional duty, it will indicate a process for nominating and confirming judges that is beyond repair. It will mean everything is subject to the most partisan of politics. Everything.
Isn't that already kind of true, though, Barbara?
Well, Mr. Obvious or Captain Obvious, do we call the president? Yes, it is obvious that everything is partisan. We're shocked to find there's gambling here. But I would also say that it would take this a step in the wrong direction for appointments, and that is I can't find in history a Supreme Court nominee who is just simply ignored and not given a hearing. I can't find that since hearings began in the late 1800s. So it would take it a step further in the wrong direction, and I wouldn't say that it's irretrievably broken, because when a president has a majority of his own party in the Senate, it wouldn't be viewed as broken, and you'd probably get through. But for this kind of situation where you have divided government, I think he's right. It would be a new break that the American people have indicated they don't want to see.
So the Republican majority, Mitch McConnell, has said, we're happy to confirm someone when they're appointed by whoever wins the election in November. So how do you see this ending? Does this new nominee just hang out for a while and then see what happens on Election Day?
What he will do is go up to the Hill and start making the usual rounds of those senators who will see him. I just heard Susan Collins today on NPR say that she would welcome him and want to see Judge Garland. In fact, that was her first vote as a senator when he was put on the D.C. Circuit 19 years ago. So there are some Republicans who would be open to that. And then hang out at his court. I mean, he's got a job. He's got a day job. So he would do that. And then I just happened to speak to a Court of Appeals judge today who said, I think what will happen is the Republicans will wait till September, October, see who the nominee of the party is, and see if they can determine who that next president will be. And if they think it's going to be a Democrat, they then actually might go forward with Judge Garland, because he would be the lesser of evils, perhaps, in the minds of Republicans.
Well, Barbara, that was our first look at Merrick Garland. I suspect it won't be the last with you. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
That's Barbara Perry, professor of political science and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. She joined us to talk about President Obama's nomination today of Merrick Garland to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Here in Wisconsin, the voters will soon be choosing the next justice to sit on our state Supreme Court.
Candidates Rebecca Bradley and Joanne Kloppenburg met for a debate last night at the Marquette University Law School in Milwaukee. With the election just a few weeks away, the race is heating up. And while the race and the position are supposed to be nonpartisan, support for and criticism of the candidates has strong political and partisan overtones.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you decided who you'll be voting for to serve on Wisconsin Supreme Court for the next 10 years? Who's earned your vote and why? And if you're still undecided, what do you need to hear in the next 3 weeks that will help you make that decision? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org.
Joining us to talk about the debate and the race in general, we have Joe Heim with us, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Joe, good to talk to you again.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Let's look at that debate a little last night. First question looked at judicial philosophies, asked the judges to define themselves on that. How are they differentiating themselves when it comes to judicial philosophy?
Well, Justice Bradley focused on her philosophy that was similar to Justice Scalia. She emphasized the idea of original meaning of the founders, and that's the philosophy she would follow. Essentially, she was saying that she'd follow the law as it is and rule accordingly. Joanne Kloppenburg, on the other hand, talked about particularly she thought the main issue of the campaign was to keep partisan politics out of the courts and keep special interests out of the courts. So they both, and she emphasized, of course, judicial independence of the court. So their statements were actually quite different.
And the idea of keeping partisan politics out of this position, that horse is already out of the barn when it comes to races for this nonpartisan office. This is a very political partisan race, isn't it?
It certainly is. It's amazing how fast in the last 10 days or so this whole race has heated up. I'll be honest, I thought maybe in February this would not have that type of an overtone to it. Despite the fact that that one candidate was appointed by the governor three times, but I just for a variety of reasons I thought maybe this would be the exception to what the rule is in Wisconsin, but it turns out not to be the case. The reason I'm saying that is that it really has to do with how much money one side or the other is going to put into a race of this sort. Right now, I think most people would acknowledge that there's four conservatives versus two more liberals on the court. And what this does is make it a 5-2 combination. Whether or not it's worth that extra vote is how much money you and a conservative force has put into it. And right now it looks like they're willing to do so.
Another issue that's come up in this debate, and not the first time when it comes to the Supreme Court, is when should a justice have to recuse her or himself? Judge Kloppenburg in this race has said the rules need to be harsher. We need to have more recusals for people if there's a case before them with someone who's donated to their campaign. Now, critics have said, hey, Judge Kloppenburg, you didn't recuse yourself in a case involving someone who spent against your election campaign, saying that's a bit of hypocrisy. So how do we sort out this recusal issue?
Well, she defended that, which I frankly did not think was very strong defense. Kloppenburg mentioned that she thought that the recusal rules in Wisconsin are amongst the weakest in the United States, and she might be right on that. Supreme Court justices basically decide on their own whether or not they should or shouldn't, and justices in general decide on their own whether they should or shouldn't get out of a case. Justice Bradley answered it, I thought, was a very interesting answer. She didn't answer it directly, but she said before she would consider recusing herself in a particular case, she would want to hear what the voters and what the public had to say about it. In other words, essentially, I don't know exactly what that meant, whether the press or the media was going to say things and that would allow her to say she should or shouldn't be involved in a particular case. But her answer really was more avoiding the question, basically, in terms of what recusal should or shouldn't be done. There was an emphasis and discussion about the West Virginia case and whether or not the Supreme Court decision applies in this particular case, or in Wisconsin, having to do with whether major contributors give a particular candidate large amounts of money. U.S. Supreme Court ruled that at a certain point, large amounts of money do affect a judicial opinion, and the result is you have to recuse yourself from that. But in both cases that we're talking about here, it isn't really clear whether that applies to this particular case. I guess that has to be decided later.
We're talking to Joe Heim, political scientist at UW-La Crosse, looking at Wisconsin's state Supreme Court race. You can join in with your thoughts. Who are you leaning toward voting for? What is important to you in a Supreme Court justice? What have you made of the race so far? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We continue our conversation now with Joe Heim from UW-La Crosse about Wisconsin State Supreme Court race.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you decided who you're going to vote for to serve on Wisconsin's Supreme Court for that 10-year stint? Who's earned your vote and why? If you're undecided, what do you need to know? Do you follow these races closely? What is important to you when it comes to electing a state Supreme Court justice? And should we elect Supreme Court justices? Other states, some do it differently. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers now. We have Sonette on the line in Lake Geneva. Sonette, hi.
Hi. Well, I will be voting for Kloppenburg. I don't think it is right to have a judge be appointed, in fact, several times appointed, by Governor Walker. She could very easily be ruling on decisions that he makes that are unpopular. You have thousands of people coming up to the Capitol to protest, but she can say, no, that's fine. He said it and it stands. And I don't want somebody like that that's beholden to, why would he keep appointing her if she didn't agree with what he wants to do and what he is doing.
Sonette, thanks a lot for that call. And Joe, I imagine that's the case for a lot of people who are critics of the governor and critics of Rebecca Bradley, but this is not unprecedented. A lot of judges at one point or another receive a political appointment somewhere along the way.
Oh, absolutely. Probably a majority of judges over time get appointed. That's been an ongoing issue for a long time in Wisconsin, whether we should appoint judges. Personally, I like the elected element to the whole thing, requiring a judge to come back before the public every 10 years for a Supreme Court case. That question, by the way, came up last night in the debate, and I was fully expecting both of them to say, we believe strongly in elected judges, and ironically, they both of them kind of ducked the question in a way. They wanted to talk about other things and other elements of their race, but what I would have to comment on in terms of the caller is that if Rebecca Bradley does win the election, then you cannot argue that she is sort of necessarily beholden to the governor. Certainly, she owes him something for being appointed originally, but essentially, the public would be endorsed that appointment if she wins in April.
Before we get back to the callers, Joe, we had a guest on a while back from UW-Milwaukee saying, you know, some states have partisan races for Supreme Court justices. So instead of sort of pretending they're nonpartisan and looking for cues, you just have a Republican candidate and a Democratic candidate. Do you think that would be an improvement or not?
I don't think it would be an improvement. I would like to think that the public would rather select a person based on who they are and what they stand for. As soon as you put a partisan label, the assumption is the person is going to make decisions based more on Democratic philosophy or Republican philosophy. I wouldn't support that at all. The fact is, however, the Supreme Court races, especially in Wisconsin, have become partisan in all but name.
Go back.
At least at the state level, you know, the circuit courts and appellate courts, we don't have anything close to that.
Go back to our callers with Leanna in Altoona. Leanna, hi.
Hi. My comment is that I'll be voting for Joanne Kloppenburg. I feel that Rebecca Bradley showed her true colors when she made those statements in college that were recorded with regard to this homophobic rhetoric that she had made, that she had documented back at that time. I feel that people do not change their views when you're way on the right, as those comments would have been and are. I don't feel that a person actually changes their views that drastically, and it doesn't matter how much time has passed. It's just not something that I buy. And I also would like to comment that thank you, Joe Heim, for mentioning that Rebecca Bradley would, in fact, be beholden to Walker should she be elected. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
Leanna, thanks for that. Joe, I think you said once she was elected by the voters, she wouldn't, if I heard you correctly, be beholden to the governor.
Let me kind of briefly comment on that issue. And the voters are going to have to decide this, basically. This was 24 years ago. She was 21 years old. Should you be held to those types of statements that you've made? She did it in print, however. It's a little stronger than just saying it orally. And what I teach my classes, by the way, is that there's a difference between values and beliefs. And the question for the public is going to be whether her statements 24 years ago really reflect values, which really don't change to any great degree in a person's lifetime, versus beliefs. Now, you can say, well, I don't believe in same-sex marriage, and then maybe a couple of years later, well, I've changed my belief on that. That may or may not be a value. So it's going to be up to the voters to decide whether something 24 years ago was really significant or not.
Well, and these articles really did, these columns really shook up the race. How have you seen that playing out in what the candidates are saying at forums, in the public, and in this debate?
Oh, it's become, these become major issues, frankly, and as opposed to focusing on perhaps what I think we ought to be focusing more on, talking about something that's years ago, years earlier. And, of course, that's not the only thing that's come up, basically. I think we're aware that other things that Rebecca Bradley has said over the years, including that fact that she represented a friend who she had prior relationship with, all those things are essentially old news that really don't have a lot to do with selecting a justice of the Supreme Court.
Talking to Joe Heim, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse, about Wisconsin's Supreme Court race. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Debate last night, debate coming up this Friday. You can hear that on Wisconsin Public Radio, by the way. Joe, I think I don't think it's too controversial to say this. A lot of people don't like the way our state Supreme Court elections have been playing out. The partisan element to them, the sort of sensationalizing, the negative advertising. Is there a better way? Are there changes we can make in the state that could give voters the information they need in a positive way that gets us good, reliable Supreme Court justices?
Well, I honestly think you have to rely on a number of sources of information. Most of us are a little bit uncomfortable voting for judges. And it's, they talk about judicial temperament. What is that? How does the average voter decide that? I think in judicial cases, first of all, you have to know that most judges get reelected without opposition. And essentially it implies that they're doing a good enough job that they don't have opposition. But essentially the public relies on, especially in Supreme Court cases, things like endorsements. For example, the first ad that Rebecca Bradley's out has to do with law enforcement support. So she's saying a lot of individuals out there involved in law enforcement are supporters of her, including a lot of unions. Kloppenburg has touted the fact, at least she mentioned last night, that she was supported by a lot of other judges, although I don't think I've seen any list of that. So we rely on what other people say. Some of us actually talk to our lawyer friends and say, what do you think about it? So endorsement from lawyers and personal knowledge of that, I think, can be helpful as well. But all in all, we're all a little bit left up in the air to be overly influenced by 30-second ads, which is, frankly, very indeed unfortunate.
And a lot of those ads come not from the candidates' campaigns themselves, but from outside groups lining up on one side or another. What do you think of the role these groups play in our Supreme Court elections?
Well, they've essentially taken over the campaigns, which is sad. There's Rabin, I think Bradley and Kloppenburg both have ads running up this week, relatively positive, I might add. Although you could say Kloppenburg, she doesn't really mention Bradley by name, but she more or less suggests that there's too much partisanship in this race. But the negative ads so far really have been from a group called the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform. I honestly don't know a lot about them. I know they get money from outside the state. They basically, they pretty much are attack ads. I think in a technical sense, they're issue ads because they both end up with things like, call Rebecca Bradley call Joanne Kloppenburg and tell her that she should change her opinion about something. Well, everybody knows that these are intended to influence the campaigns. But the negative ads so far pretty much have come from that group, an outside group. And I would guess that they're going to be spending a lot more money than Bradley herself is going to.
Mentioned that debate coming up on Friday from Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, Friday at 7. What, Joe, would you like to hear from the candidates? What would make us more informed Supreme Court voters?
I really would like to ask them to convince us that they are, in fact, independent and are not going to be beholden to either the governor or beholden to groups that support them, basically. I think the public would love to have a swing vote on the Supreme Court, somebody that that would judge things based on facts. Just talking about philosophy doesn't necessarily do it, but I think that's what the public would want to hear. Maybe a little bit more about their backgrounds and their experiences and why that would lead the public to think that they would be a good Supreme Court justice.
We'll leave it there for now. Joe, thanks as always for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Rob.
That's Joe Heim, professor of political science at UW-La Crosse, discussing the race for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The election is on Tuesday, April 5th. And remember, you can hear the candidates debate this Friday at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television.